session number 7266, reel 3.
General Lloyd, reel 3. General, you're with the 12th Division in Kent. When did you first hear that you were going to France?
I'm not absolutely certain, but I should think it was about March of 1940. I went with the advance party, the divisional advance party, and we embarked at Southampton, and this is the one date I'm really certain about because it was my birthday, the 14th of April, 1940. We, of course, had... the original intention was that the 12th Division should be brought up to strength in due course and then trained in the UK and then sent to France. But in March, we learnt that we were to be sent to France. And the reason given for it then was we were to help in the completion of the Maginot Line, extension of the Maginot Line from its northern end to the Channel. And we were to do a sort of combined job of helping to extend the Maginot Line to the sea, and at the same time we were to receive our artillery and our communications troops and so on, and come up to full strength and then train. But in the event, this didn't happen.
How are you going to actually accomplish this work of extending the Maginot Line?
Well, I just said this didn't actually happen, so all I can say is that I was one of those who went on a reconnaissance to see the sort of work we were trying to take, but I hasten to say that we never did in fact undertake it because the Battle of France started, but really before we were in position. Chief engineer of the expeditionary force had of course. Perhaps I should say that the winter of 1939 was exceptionally hard in France, and it soon became apparent, certainly to me, I'm not sure whether it was to others, but I'm not sure to what extent this is hindsight, but the sappers, the British sappers in the expeditionary force on the lines of communication had been using hydraulic drills and so on to get into the ground, which was so hard, and the idea was to build an enormous mass of concrete pillboxes from the northern end of the Maginot Line to the Channel. In fact, when we got over there, those that had been completed, the concrete had not set properly, and very few of them were in a satisfactory state. But all this work came to an end with the beginning of the Battle of France in...
May.
That's right.
But when you were told you were going to do this, did they give you detailed orders as to drawing special equipment or anything of
no,
that sort?
No. We were sent hastily to France, and the intention was that we should pick up whatever we needed when we got out there.
Sounds as if the idea was to use your infantry as pick and shovel labour.
Use our own, that's quite right, quite right.
Now, you went ahead with the advance party on the reconnaissance. Who was in the advance party?
I can remember that with some certainty. The advance party consisted of the transport officers of each of the nine battalions in the division. That were the those were the Queens and the West Kents, and the transport officers. One vehicle per battalion. That would be about nine vehicles. A detachment from divisional headquarters, of which I took command, and altogether about 12 vehicles. And I think we had two additional officers. And of course, brigade headquarters. That's nine vehicles, three brigade headquarters, and two from divisional headquarters. We had no signals, no artillery, no engineers, so that would be the lot. We embarked at Southampton.
Do you remember what sort of ship you were on?
It was a cross-channel steamer, quite a small one, about 4,000 or 5,000 tons. I can't remember its name. Not at this stage. We were a very small proportion of the total load on board. We had on board the Manchester Regiment, which was a heavy machine gun battalion, something which I don't think exists nowadays. They had Vickers machine guns.
Where did you disembark?
We disembarked at Havre. And the first night in France was at the brand-new transatlantic terminal, which had just been completed. We were to see that again later on when we came back. Or on the way back, we disembarked. The next day, we drove forward to a village north of Rouen, due north of Rouen, Forges-les-Eaux, and divisional headquarters was billeted in the Chateau de Gailly-Fontaine, and it was of great interest to us because the owner of the chateau was the Comte du Roi, R-O-I, the Count of the King, very strange title. He and his family remained in residence, and they occupied one wing of the chateau, and we had all the rest of it. Our divisional commander was the only Roman Catholic general in the army at that time, General Peter, P-E-T-R-E.
From Ingatestone.
Pardon?
From Ingatestone, yes.
Yes. Essex. Yes, that's right.
What were your orders while you were on this reconnaissance? Was it simply to spy out the ground for your particular area of work?
We reported to headquarters lines of communications, and we were simply given the orders to occupy the chateau as a divisional headquarters, to make arrangements for billeting the headquarters staff in and around the chateau and in the village of Forges-les-Eaux, and the various brigades were located forward of us, that was north of us, and I remember that the 36th Brigade was at the village of EU. I don't know how you pronounce that. I'm not sure. EU, presumably. That was the brigade commanded by Brigadier Ruppel, VC.
How did you get on with the Comte du Roy while you were living in his chateau?
Oh, extremely well. I personally used to play chess with him about three times a week, and he got on extremely well with my general when he eventually arrived, which was just a few days later. We had the most excellent relations with him. During the period that we were there, we used to exchange visits to his quarters, his and his family's quarters. I'm talking now about the officers of headquarters, 12th Division. And our relations also with the villagers were extremely good. In fact, no difficulty about that at all.
How long were you actually based at the chateau?
Not a long time. I was there from about the 16th of April until the time when the expeditionary force had made contact with the Germans, which was the time when we were all ordered forward. So it would be a period of about, what would that be, about 6 weeks, wouldn't it?
A bit less than that, probably
about four weeks, altogether. See, in retrospect, seems much longer now, of course, than it actually was.
What was your sort of daily work routine while you were based there?
Well, we were extremely busy because, as I've already said, we had to draw all our equipment, which included vehicles in particular, were necessary for the work that we were going to do, which was this business of helping to complete the Maginot Line. Weapons, of course, were not in great supply. I remember that I had my father's old World War I pistol, and we officers were equipped. The only issue weapon we had were rifles. And of course, it also has to be remembered that we'd hardly shaken down as a division from first mobilisation. And this was the first move of any magnitude that we'd ever undertaken. So it was rarely, I suppose, an exercise in the logistics of movement more than anything else.
So you were sorting out locations and billets for the locations,
billets, you know, making the battalions up to strength, drawing clothing, such equipment as was available, was, of course, as you probably know, scattered all over the lines of communication, this stuff. We did have our own Army Service column. A divisional column, which was commanded by a Major R.W. Smith, who became a close friend of mine. Later on, he was literally to quarter the west of France to pick up weapons and equipment for us when the battle was actually joined and we were involved in it.
So he was on a sort of freelance freebooting expedition in the rear, was he?
Roving commission in the rear.
Did he have the right sort of piratical mentality for this?
Oh, he did. He had absolutely the right mentality for it. He was marvellous. In fact, just to jump ahead a bit, when we got on the move later on, of course, the German bombing dislocated the water supply, and the medical officer warned us off drinking, and I well remember Smithy, as we used to call him, collecting case after case of champagne, and for a while we existed on bully beef, champagne, and ship's biscuits. There was no bread when the battle was joined. Ship's biscuits, which I remember were made by a Liverpool firm, and the trademark was Ixion, Ixion, Ixion ship biscuits. Terribly hard, the old-fashioned hard ship's biscuit.
But proof against weevils, presumably.
That's right, weevil proof.
How long after you arrived in France did the rest of the division start coming across?
Within days, the GSO1 Colonel Leader, I remember, and the administrative, the AANQMG, the Lieutenant Colonel Administrator, they arrived on the 17th of April, by which time we were at the chateau, and the general arrived with his ATC and the rest of the divisional headquarters. They arrived shortly after that. That would be about the 19th of April, I would think. And they were simply the head of the column formed by the main body of the troops. So it was a pretty expeditious move. Of course, it was really no distance from Kent to Southampton. Everybody embarked from Southampton, and there was a constant stream of troops. The line was Southampton to Havre, and from Havre up to, by our own transport, up to Forges-les-Eaux.
So you had your own transport sorted out by the time the main body started coming across?
Yes, yes, we did. There was no shortage of transport, but of course it wasn't the stuff that we were really ought to have received. It was makeshift lorries and so on, makeshift civilian lorries.
Were they all properly painted up and badged, do you remember?
They were properly painted up and badged, yes, yes.
How many days do you think it took the division to actually move the main body across from England to France and into Forges-les-Eaux?
I should think from the time the advance party started, that was the 14th of April. We'd start from Sevenoaks about the 13th. We got to Southampton on the 14th. That's when I embarked. And I remember having dinner at the Polygon Hotel in Southampton before embarking. The whole division was across safely and as complete as we ever could be at that stage by the 27th of April.
So it's about a fortnight.
About a fortnight.
What did the division do once it had arrived?
Well, there was a period of about a week in which everybody was more or less in position where they should have been. That was the 36th Brigade at this place, EU. We used to call it U. The 35th Brigade was to the west of that, but I can't remember the name of the village. And the 37th Brigade was to the east of it, and again, I can't remember the actual village, even if there was one. I'm not sure there was a village. I don't remember. I never visited them. The only brigade I visited was the 36th Brigade.
So they were settled into their billets, which you had previously wrecked and got...
That's right.
...named for them.
And all the advance parties of the brigades and the infantry battalions, they all, as soon as... They dropped us off, so to speak, at the chateau, and they went on forward and established their own brigade headquarters and battalion and reconnoitred for billeting. Oh, I should have said, by the way, that all the troops at that stage were in the whole division were billeted.
Did you go up to the Franco-Belgian frontier at all to look at the...
Yes. about a week after we got to Guyfontaine, I'm not sure whether everybody went, but I certainly went with about three other officers and the divisional commander to have a look at the Maginot Line. And we were the guests of the headquarters of one of the French divisions that were occupying. It was the middle division, I remember. And I was immensely impressed with the Maginot Line. And having had no experience whatever, of course, of warfare at that time, in common with a host of others, we, of course, regarded the Maginot Line as being impregnable. From there, we went and had a look at the western end of the Maginot Line and the extension, which was to be the division's task during the coming week, but which never came off. So far as I know, the total involvement of the division with this part of the, you know, the extension of the Maginot Line was confined simply to reconnaissance. And no detailed plans for any work were ever completed.
Presumably they'd have been made by engineers at engineer officers at...
I'm absolutely certain that the Expeditionary Force engineers had adequate plans, you know, in mind, but we certainly never saw them, nor were they ever transmitted to us formally.
When you went to the Maginot Line, you were entertained at a French divisional headquarters.
Yes, actually, underground in the Maginot Line,
which must have made it all more impressive.
Oh yes, tremendously impressive. In fact, we only did. I was just thinking about being underground. They first of all, oddly enough, took us right forward of the Maginot Line, presumably to show us the field of fire and the terrain covered by the guns. We were out there about the best part of a day, and I remember that we travelled right forward some 2 miles or thereabouts. And then we came back and we went into divisional headquarters that evening. I can't give you the date. And we were entertained at dinner by the French division. I think it was the French 3rd Division, but I'm not absolutely certain of that. It'll presumably be in the history.
What impression did you form of the French troops in the line?
I'm sorry to say that my general impression of French troops by comparison with British troops, ours at that time were impeccably dressed. They were very smart in appearance. And by contrast, the French conscript was very, very scruffy. although, on the other hand, the actual operation of equipment, guns, was highly efficient. They were obviously well trained on their equipment. The guns came up and were aimed and simulated firing, carried out impeccably, and the guns went back in their casings. Ammunition loaders were efficiently operated, but my overall impression of the whole operation of the Maginot Line was one of complete lifelessness. There was no spirit about it.
As though they were just going through a drill?
Just through a dreary drill in which they weren't interested.
How about the officers in the divisional headquarters?
The staff officers were superb. They were, of course, regulars, and they were of the highest tradition. And as I told you in conversation the last time we met, we had been brought up in the French staff tradition, and the actual staff officers came quite up to expectation. The regimental officers of artillery and so on that actually manned the weapons were not very impressive. The actual status of this division that we were with, I was never quite sure about. Whether it was a regular division, especially constituted for the Maginot Line, or whether it was a reserve division, there just for training purposes, I just don't know. I had the impression that the staff officers were permanent, but that the other units were not permanent and were probably circulated.
Did you discuss the war and its progress with the French officers?
Very, very little. Only in conversation over meals. Mainly, we were obsessed with the excitement and the newness of being on the famous Maginot Line, and that tended to exclude other topics of conversation.
So you were in the position of tourists amazed by an
artifact. That's right, tourists amazed by technical complexity.
What sort of ground did you have to look at when you went up to see the site of your possible extension or potential extension?
Well, it was typical terrain, of course, of what would have been northern.